From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The American death toll for COVID-19 is well over 110,000. That's as many deaths as if more than 200 747s just fell out of the sky. It's double the American casualties over 9 years in the Vietnam War. In terrible accidents and costly wars, family and friends gather together to mourn. Even the nation witnesses the impact of the loss through pictures of funerals and flag-draped caskets. But in this pandemic, there's a double loss: the death and the denial of the chance to gather together. And instead, people are left to mourn against this strange backdrop of shelter-in-place orders and quarantine. So this hour on Point, we'll talk about reinventing the rituals of bereavement in the time of COVID-19. And joining us from Indian River, Michigan, is Thomas Lynch. He's a writer, poet, and an undertaker. With his family, he runs Lynch and Sons Funeral Directors, which operates funeral homes in Wayne and Oakland counties, Michigan. His book, The Undertaking, Life Studies from a Dismal Trade, was a finalist for the National Book Award in 1997, and he's most recently author of The Despositions, New and Selected Essays on Being and Ceasing to Be. It was released last November, and he joins us today from Indian River, Michigan. Thomas Lynch, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Greetings to you.
And I apologize for stumbling through the introduction to you there. I suppose it's just that day after day, all of us collectively are sort of bearing this double loss that I talked about. Some people individually have that first person loss of a loved one, and then all of us, we can't even support those who we wish to support in the way we can. I mean, what has this experience been like, first of all, for you, Thomas Lynch, in the past couple of months?
I love your use of the word bearing, Meghna, because it invokes the notion of a sort of large muscle involvement with this, the burden of grief and mourning and bereavement. And it has a lot to do with that, the title that you were stumbling over as I stumble over. It's called The Depositions. And it's actually a term of art, and it refers to the removal of the body of Jesus from the cross at Calvary. And this was done by Joseph of Arimathea and his sidekick Nicodemus, and in cahoots they did this deal with, I think his name was Pontius Pilate, to take the body of Christ from the place where the death occurred to the place that they had assigned, the abyss that they had assigned to him, which was a tomb they had in within walking distance, because it is a heavy lift, the death of someone we care about, isn't it? So for me, it's been like, in our work, we're taking care of the dead as they need to be taken care of. But I think for the living, as you quite properly say, it's a kind of insult being added to the existential injury of the death of, in a family. And to witness that is difficult.
Right. Yeah. Well, we want to talk about how to soothe both the insult and the injury this hour. But I did hear you say that we are taking care of the dead in the way that they need to be taken care of. But certainly protocols around handling remains must be different right now.
They are, of course, because of the the contagion and the pestilence and the worry over those things. But this extends not only to the dying who are dying alone, but to the dead who are kept separate from the human impulse to gather around and console and hug and condole with. And so all of our human impulses that surround mortality are short-circuited by the contagion, this plague of ours. And I've always said that it is by getting the dead where they need to go that the living get where they need to be. That's sort of the formula for a good funeral.
Right.
And so it is this commingling of purposes. The dead need to get someplace where their decomposition won't embarrass their memory. And the living need to get them out of the place they're in to a place that we assign to them, usually a fire or a tomb or a grave or the sea or a tree in the desert or a rock where we can count on scavenger birds to come. And in something we think of as sacramental, pick the bones clean, mm-hmm. as they do in Tibet. So there's the human. We are all the same, but different in this these difficult offices. We want to go the distance with our dead, and COVID-19 makes the dead dangerous to us in ways that they didn't seem before.
Right, and so it's produced this. Really sad pause is the best way I can come up with it, the best way I can describe it, a discomforting pause. Because even in the case of helping the dead get to where they need to go regarding their remains, I mean, we have cases where people are passing away due to COVID-19. Obviously, they cannot have a funeral, no gathering. They are taken to a crematorium. The remains cremated, and the family members may not even be able to get those cremated remains for some time. Then, in order to move to the next phase of getting to where they need to go, so there's this distance even after death, which must be so hard to handle. I don't even know how else to put it.
Well, in the very same way that this pandemic has overwhelmed our religious and economic and medical infrastructures, it could be counted on to overwhelm our mortuary infrastructures. So you're exactly right. A crematory that may have handled 15 cremations in a day is now being called on to handle 45, and they just can't do that. It takes time. So this detachment, detachment from our dead. We're going to wait our turn now to celebrate a life. The dead don't wait for that. The dead, and you can try this at home, the dead are on a fairly tight schedule. The changes in a dead human body, the corpse begins to change immediately. And the reason we have, as a species, developed ways to do things that we can't put in words, we act them out. And we've acted out the processing of our dead. We process our dead by getting them from one station to another in this sort of catalog of sadnesses, from the gathering around the corpse, the wake or vigil or Shiva or whatever the culture wants to call it. We get together, and then we move them to their oblivion. We do this with song and prayer or poems or symbols. And the acting out, these behaviors are ways to act out things that are mysterious to us. We don't quite get, even though we know the numbers on mortality are fairly convincing. They hover right around 100%. We never quite get used to it. We always wonder when it happens, what do we do now? And the culture always does its part to sort of organize a wheel to work the space between the living and the dead. But those infrastructures are broken at the moment, too.
Right.
So we're all sort of, I think the metaphor is building the plane in midair.
Yeah. Now, when you said the numbers around mortality are pretty convincing, you mean the numbers, the absolute numbers for us all eventually.
Yeah. What's born dies. Yeah.
Now, if I might,
no exceptions.
If I might ask you, Thomas, so you have been a funeral director for a half century.
Years.
A half century. Yeah. At this point in time, though, I read that your son has said you're retired but not required, because it may not be safe for you to do the work at the moment.
He instructed me to come up north and stay put until I heard otherwise, yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about what your son is experiencing, about what's happening at the
funeral home?
Yeah.
There is this sense of helplessness that we always feel around a death in the family, but it's amplified, I think, by the fact that we must tell people that they're limited in the case of Michigan, and I think in many places throughout the nation, any gathering is limited to 10 people. Well, if you count the pallbearers and the widowed spouse and the surviving son and daughter and the preacher, you've hit the limit. Mm-hmm. So the fella that was in the bowling league with your grandfather, the one that went to work with him at the post office every day, those people don't have anything to say about what's going on. They can't show up to take their part of the hard lift of grief on their shoulders and walk along with you. And the math of bereavement is fairly simple. You know, the more the merrier. The more people who are willing to take on their part of it, the less each of us feels duty-bound to bear alone. And even though grief is a lonely thing, so I think my son feels going home more helpless and more desolate than he normally does, because while he can take care of the essential offices for the dead, he speaks to the living on the phone or on the internet rather than in person, face to face. Mm-hmm. So this separation of essential offices is cruel.
Yeah. Well, we are talking about bereavement in the midst of a pandemic, and we'll discuss a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about bereavement in a pandemic and how we help ferry each other through this time when we can't gather together to mourn the people, the loved ones, the friends that have been lost. I'm joined today by Thomas Lynch. He's an author, a poet, and an undertaker. With his family, he runs Lynch and Sons Funeral Directors. He's author of several books, the most recent, The Depositions, New and Selected Essays on Being and Ceasing to Be. And I just want to play a couple of little bits of tape here. In March, we spoke with David Kessler, speaker and writer, best known for his work with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross on grief. And he talked to us about the collective grief of the way of life that many people feel has been lost due to this pandemic. And then David Kessler also said this.
At the same time, the other end is there are people who have had loved ones die in the past month, in the past week, in the past day, who for the first time in our history, no matter whether you look back at war or 9/11 or the AIDS crisis, AIDS epidemic, we've never not been able to bury our dead or have a funeral or go to a grief group.
Well, that is very true for On Point listener Di from Sarasota, Florida. She left us a voicemail. Her mother died on May 10th, Mother's Day, in a nursing home.
We had not been able to physically visit with her since mid-March. We tried a few Skype phone calls, but it was hard for her to really understand what was happening. We tried one visit where she was inside the glass at the front door and we were outside, and that was the only time I saw her before she passed. They did not call us if there had been signs that she was actively dying because she was receiving hospice care. We were not called and given any opportunity to come and say goodbye. And that was very sad and very frustrating for me especially.
That's Di, an On Point listener from Sarasota, Florida. Thomas Lynch, let me just ask you briefly, what is the injury that's done to the living when they can't even do something as simple but profound as holding their loved one's hand in their last moments?
I think it was Eric Lindemann, a behavioral scientist who did the landmark study on acute grief and bereavement. Actually, he studied the survivors of the Coconut Grove disaster, if I'm not mistaken. That took place in your listening area. And one of the things he found about people surviving such things, such overwhelming disasters, was an acute preoccupation with the image of the deceased. And this is why teenage boys will rummage through the album of pictures of their lost girlfriend when they break up. Teenage girls, I think, do the same thing. But what Di is talking about is that she has not had any confrontation with the new reality of her mother not dying, but being dead. Mm-hmm. And that reality is embodied, incarnate in the corpse. And for 50 years, our culture has been trying to sort of have funerals without the corpse there. It's the sort of commemorative equivalent of having a baptism without the baby or a wedding without the bride and groom. It lacks a focus. But suddenly we are pitched into a circumstance in which we cannot choose to do away with the corpse. We are told the corpse has been gotten its riddance of us because we had to. So the wound is deep and permanent because we can't do what Eric Lindemann believed was one of the essential obligations, which was to resolve. By confronting the dead, we resolve what it is that has been lost. It's not the idea of the thing, Meghna. It's the thing itself. Mm. It's mom or Pete or our child.
Yeah.
The real thing.
It makes so much sense to me, Thomas, because, you know, even in cases where family members go missing, separate from the pandemic, even if it's been years and years and years and decades, people won't give up the search, right?
Yeah.
They will not give up the search until they have the body.
And you're using exactly the right word. It is a search because until we find it, this is the thing that happens every time we used to have what we called 3 months ago, a wake. Mm-hmm. You know, the living would walk into a room at the end of which there was a box with a body in it. And as they approached this body, what was pummeling their rich internal life was, this is so, this is so, this can't be so. And it was going against your other guest, Mr. Kessler, that you played a part of. Kubler-Ross made known the fact that our first response to many of these things is denial. When you get word of your aunt's death of pneumonia suddenly, oh no, we don't believe it. So denial is real. And the reason we've always laid the dead out among the living is because it's hard to deny death when you're touching its now lifeless hand or kissing its now lifeless forehead.
Well, if you can hang on for just a moment, Thomas, I want to now welcome into the conversation Nora McInerney. She's host of Terrible Thanks for Asking, a podcast from American Public Media. She's also co-founder of Still Kickin', an organization that provides direct relief to people undergoing hardship, including losing a loved one. And she's co-founder of the Hot Young Widows Club, an online support group for those who have lost loved ones. Nora, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, you know how you just heard Thomas talking about that there are certain like foundations to how we ritualize the kind of loss that death is. How are you processing this moment that there's so much of that loss happening right now across the country?
Across the country. Well, the thing is, a lot of those traditions were things that only some people could afford. Mm-hmm. So it's expensive to have a wake. It's expensive to preserve a body. It's so expensive to bury one. It is bananas and prohibitive for a lot of people, including myself. So we cremated Aaron because, one, he was 35 years old. We watched the reality of his death happen over 3 years. I watched him go from a young 31-year-old to a 35-year-old and a 100-year-old body. And what we could afford was a cremation. What we could afford was a free space that was lent to us, a huge art gallery where, yes, 1,000 people came, but grief doesn't end at a funeral. And the long-term view, what I want to tell everybody is that this will be a chronic condition. So show up in the long term. And so many people can show up at a funeral, can do the bare minimum of walking in, signing a guest book, handing you a card, maybe bringing you a lasagna a few weeks later. And we don't have that. Mm-hmm. But you know what we still have? You know what I still get from people 5 years later? I get Aaron as a living person because his death is real, but also so is his life. And that is what I want to remember. I want an email from somebody who went to high school with him who can tell me about a version of Aaron that I never met.
Yeah.
And that's what I want.
Aaron, your husband who died in 2014.
Yes. I mean, yes, sir. So not everyone is on a first name basis with my dead husband. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, just to help those of us who aren't.
Yeah.
But that was a really terrible year for you, Nora.
Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. And a lot happened. We lost my dad. We had a very traditional funeral for my dad. He was a Catholic. He wanted to be buried in a pine box made by monks in Iowa. We did that. And the person I saw in that coffin wasn't my dad. It was like a wax statue wearing my dad's suit. So, but that ceremony, that was important to him. Mm-hmm. That ceremony, having a mass, having, you know, all of his children say prayers that meant a lot to him, that was for him. And what has helped in the interim, and I don't want to downplay the importance of having, if you can, but it is a privilege to be able to have some sort of ceremony, have somebody hug you is so great. But not everybody who showed up physically was there mentally or emotionally for me. At my husband's funeral, someone said to me, "Don't worry, you're still pretty. You'll find someone else." Like, I would have preferred not to see that person at the funeral if that's the kind of support I was going to get. But what is still possible in this terrible era is for us to show up in so many ways emotionally for people, and to do that with some consistency. And I am so sorry. Sorrow has always been lonely. Grief has always been lonely. It is not a feeling that can be divided. I could not parse it out and hand it to every person who attended the funeral or sent me a card. It is yours to bear. It is an individual sport, but you need to know that there are people who are cheering for you.
Right. Well, just to be blunt about it, right now, the ways to be there for each other, as you're saying, Nora, are really technologically mediated. And it's just going to have to be that way for a while. Is that enough? I mean, does it have to be enough right now?
It's not enough. And also, when you are an acutely grieving person, in those first 6 to 12 months, nothing's enough. Mm-hmm. Nothing feels good enough, because it's not. Because you want your person back. Because you want the impossible. So when we approach grief as, how can I fix this? How can I make you feel better? It's wrong. You're not going to do it. You're going to feel awkward. They're going to feel worse. You're going to feel terrible. So approach it as, how can I show up and just witness your pain however I can? And so maybe that's every day you send this person a text. And maybe it's that you even schedule emails. And some of them are just about something completely different. And some of them are about the life that their loved one lived. Helping from a distance is basically telling the person who is grieving, I also remember this person's life mattered and it matters to me. Mm-hmm. And you miss them in a way that nobody else does. Your grief is yours.
Right.
But over here, I'm feeling it too for them. You are not crazy. You are not the only person who's missing them. Mm. They were real.
Thomas, respond to what Nora is saying about how we can use the technological means that we have at the moment to support each other. I mean, is that a satisfactory way of we talked about sharing the burden of grief earlier?
Yeah, I see this. First of all, I want to extend my sympathy at the death of your husband. I've never buried a spouse. God help us. That said, I've spent a good deal of time with hot young widows and some hot old widows to boot. And I do know that in 50 years of dealing with them, much of what Nora has to say is absolutely so. You feel utterly alone, utterly unique, completely helpless. But I'm thinking of my cousin Nora Lynch, who occupied a home alone on the west coast of County Clare, where I've been going for 50 years and inherited the hovel and the neighbors and the rest of it. So I've been to a good few Irish wakes. Nora McInerney is exactly right that funerals are pricey, but it is not the essential elements that are pricey. The boxes, the mum plants, the bagpipers, the brouhaha, all come with a bill of lading. But the essential elements, the corpse, the mourners, the story, and the transport, those are human endeavors which are largely free to do. Nora Lynch was a peasant woman who lived alone after her brother died in 1971. She lived to be 90 in a house without a bathroom, without a TV, without, she lived like people did up until the 20th century. But she lived that way up until nearly the 21st century. And when she died, the house, she was laid out in her own bed with a prayer book to prop her chin closed to keep her mouth from opening. Someone put something on her eyes to keep them closed. She was laid out in her best outfit with a rosary to keep her hands tied together, candles at the bedside table, a crucifix, because that was part of her story. Whatever she believed in or had faith in or doubted from time to time, whatever God she shook her fist in the face of when crops failed or cows died or her brother died. That was part of her. She was an Irish Catholic disbeliever or doubter or wanderer or faithful servant of.
Right.
So the funeral, whatever form it takes, getting the dead to their fire. And I need to say this because as a culture, we're missing the boat. More of our people, more of our dead are burned now than buried. Everyone has in the back of their brain box a memory of going to graveside. Very few have a memory of going to the fireside. And that's because we love the industrial strength of cremation, the efficiency of it. We just don't get the elemental gift that fire is in the way they do, say, in Calcutta, where the crematory is public, the fire is initiated by the firstborn son, or failing that, the firstborn daughter, and people stand and watch because they see in that fire light, warmth, cleansing, and a metaphor for healing. Mm. Our metaphor for this pandemic is the trench burials at Hart Island in New York, or the refrigerated trucks at the loading docks of every hospital on the East Coast and many in the Midwest and across the country. So I do believe that grief is deeply personal. It happens at 3 a.m. when we're sleeping alone. But the lift is communal. We need one another.
Right. Well, Thomas Lynch and Nora McInerney. Nora, and I'll have you respond to all that Thomas said when we come back from this quick break. So hang on. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about bereavement and how we support each other through the loss of friends and family in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm joined today by Thomas Lynch. With his family, he runs the Lynch & Sons Funeral Directors, which operates 6 funeral homes in Wayne and Oakland counties, Michigan. He's also an author, a poet, and an undertaker. And Nora McInerney is with us as well from Phoenix, Arizona. She's host of Terrible, Thanks for Asking, a podcast from American Public Media, and author of several books, including the memoir No Happy Endings. Now, Nora, before the break, Thomas was talking a lot about that communal lift, as he said, that we need to collectively undertake for bereavement. What's your response to what he said?
I thought it was beautiful. And honestly, Thomas, your voice is so beautiful that I really, it was a little bit of ASMR and I felt like I might be in a dream. I would like to hire you to narrate bedtime stories for me, but we can talk about that on the side. The communal lift is beautiful, and the communal lift is often, not just because of a pandemic, not possible for people to do in person. Aaron died. My husband died in 2014. We were young people. We were in our early 30s. Not everybody we knew could afford to fly to Minneapolis, where we lived, in winter, spend time at, you know, in a hotel, show up for a funeral. So we live streamed our funeral ceremony. And my friend Nancy, who knew Aaron and knew me and knew our family, officiated. And all of our friends and family who could not make it in real life were there. Uh-huh. And that was beautiful. But I also had, and this is a very Western, very, very American problem, where I had never seen grief. I had been to funerals as a child, and it was evident to me that it felt emotionally like that was supposed to be the end for us. It was an ending, and really it was a beginning. That is when the real work of grief begins. So if you can think of it that way, how can you lift up, if you're a grief adjacent person, how can you lift up your grieving friend, your grieving sister or mother over the long term? And a lot of that is communal remembrance, which honestly you can do from anywhere. Yeah. You can. And we have all of these ways to do it now. And it is not as good as having someone sit on the couch next to you and cry. And also, I will tell you, as a person who had people come over and show up physically, that a lot of those people weren't able to share any load with me. They wanted me to be okay, and their presence actually forced me into this pretending where I was okay. Trust me. Yes, it's sad, but I am okay. That's where the name of my podcast, Terrible Things for Asking, comes from. That was an aspirational response that I wish I would have just told people. So, and that's a huge cultural shift that needs to happen, which is the funeral is not. It's the end for the person that you are burying or the person that you are later going to, you know, sprinkle into a lake semi-illegally. But for the person who is grieving, that inner circle of grief, that really is the beginning. That's a jumping off point. It's not, it's going to hurt for a while, for a long while. And that's okay.
Yeah. Nora, can I ask you, right now, we're also still in the midst of this pandemic. So no matter where anybody turns, you know, a loved one, a friend who has lost someone to this pandemic, there is the constant reminder of the circumstances of that loss, right? Or the thing that caused the death of their loved one. I mean, our whole lives are defined by those circumstances at the moment. Does it make it easier or harder? Because you talked about the death of the person being the launching point for those who are left behind. Is it harder because there's never any break from the reminder of how this tragedy happened?
Yeah. There's in the first few weeks, there's never any break anyways. Yeah, yeah. You can see, I'll give you an example. I was at my favorite place in the world, Target, which is also my dead husband's favorite place in the world. And there was just a person existing, and he was around Aaron's age. And I burst into tears. Just the existence of a 35-year-old man who looked nothing like Aaron was too much for me. And I just was staring at him crying. And he was not comfortable with that, I would say. But we have a group in the Hot Young Widows Club, which I just want to say is not just for women. And it's hot is a relative term. And I think everyone is attractive. Everyone is in the club. It's just a name. But we have a special group that we started for people who lost their partner in this pandemic, not necessarily to COVID, but in this moment, because it is such a unique experience. It is so different for them than it is for me, because we had, empathy is not an unlimited resource out there. Theoretically it is, but people get empathy fatigue pretty quickly. And there is sort of this sliding scale. Well, how did your husband die? Oh, well, he died by suicide. He died by brain cancer. Oh yes. I will give you all of my sympathy. But people who have lost their partner, who have lost anybody during this pandemic, are feeling as if their loss is being overshadowed, as if there isn't enough sadness to go around. And I think that's a very real fear for them. I think that is extremely valid, because when everybody is suffering, it feels like nobody really has the right to say it. And that is wrong. There is no, you know, grief Olympics. There is no, you know, number one sorrow trophy that we can pass around. There's no, you know, objective measure of who's got it worse. But when everybody is doing poorly, it does feel like, well, maybe mine doesn't matter as much, or maybe people don't have the time for it. And honestly, when Aaron died, I was the only 31-year-old widow in our group of friends, if you can believe it. So people had a lot of space for me, and I still didn't feel like it was enough.
Yeah.
And now, when your friends might have lost their jobs, when your friends might be, you know, just extremely anxious, dealing with a lot of their own stuff, trying to educate their children from home while holding down a full-time job, of course you would feel like there might not be enough, because there might not be.
Right. Thomas, would you, your thoughts on that?
Well, I love listening to Nora as well, because there's no tuition like having gone through this. And I do want to repeat my emphasis on the essential elements, and the corpse being the first one. Unless we can get someone to agree to quit breathing forever, we don't have funerals. We don't have celebrations of life or any other memorial events. It's about a death. It's about someone ceasing to be. And the reason I think the presence of the corpse, I worked with Alan Ball. I had a small correspondence when he was doing 6 Feet Under, I guess was the name of the HBO show about undertakers and death in Southern California. Once he wrote to me and he said, Magna, Lynch, I finally figured out the formula. You've known it all along. Once you put a dead guy in the room, you can talk about anything. Hmm. And he was spot on, or as we sometimes say, dead right, because the presence of the dead at their own wake and funeral ups the existential ante. It is the horizontal mystery at the end of the room that keeps everybody sort of on point. It is the focus. It is the thing we're doing here. It's not a digital loss. It's not a virtual loss. It is an actual dead body. And I do think the getting the dead where they need to go, the distance we go with our dead is hard won territory, but that transport is essential. Uh-huh. That is the process. So I don't think they need to be in a pricey box. They don't need to have a brass band or bagpipers. They don't need to have mum plants. Those are all fashion differences, accessories. But the real deal, getting the dead to their grave or tomb or fire or sea, getting the dead someplace where they're going to stay and we're not, that is what grief is about. The letting go with claw marks, more or less.
Right.
The letting go of the huge emotional investment we have made in that dead person. Mm-hmm. Because until we get it back, we cannot reinvest again.
Well, you know, we've been getting some feedback from listeners about this conversation online. And Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, is here to share some of that.
Scott on Facebook sent us a message, you know, about that struggle getting his father's body back to the United States. He died in Mexico. They're not exactly sure whether he died from COVID or not, but at the end of April. And he says his family is struggling with this issue, that they want to get his remains back home before they're able to celebrate his life. Speaking to exactly what you were just talking about.
About getting the dead to where they need to be. Now, Nora, I am curious about, there's the personal grief that we've been talking about and how, yes, you're exactly right, it lasts a long time. And that, I think, another way of looking at the importance of the collective lift that we've been talking about, you said earlier about being there 3 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, in whatever capacity you can, for the people who are bereaved. At the same time, I'm wondering about our national bereavement, that this has happened, Like there, I think it's fair to say there is a collective national loss as well. Do we know how to do that as a country?
Oh, no. I would urge everybody who has a full-time job with benefits to check what your bereavement policy is, because I'm willing to bet you'll get 3 whole days if you lose a spouse, if you lose a sibling or a parent or a child, and if you lose your best friend, if you lose your way of life, nothing. So we are a country who has commoditized the value of a death, of a loss, and who has basically turned that into the equivalent of a billable hour. And we are left and have been for a long time to either the strength of our social networks, who can pull together some sort of online fundraiser that will allow us the time and space to grieve. Grief happens to everybody. Everybody in the world experiences grief long before somebody dies. I had grief the minute that Aaron was diagnosed with stage 4 brain cancer, but nobody told me that. Nobody told me that this weight that I carried for those years, that was grief. I was grieving the life that we would not have. And people all over, you referenced David Kessler, and he has that beautiful piece in the Harvard Business Review called "What You're Feeling Now is Grief." But we are not a culture that respects grief. We are not a culture that respects life. And you can see that at the two ends of life. If you adopt a baby, if you give birth, good luck. You will be paid possibly a partial salary for a few weeks, and then you can just not be paid and you'll go back to work before your child is even somewhat, you know, legible. I'm going to use the word legible, but you know what? They're not even smiling at you yet. And you have to just leave them behind and get back to your work if you are lucky enough to have leave. And the same happens at the end of life. So we are not a culture that respects life at all. And hopefully, you know, an ideal world, like having this communal sense of loss where we are losing are the places that we typically gather. We can't go to, you know, our places of worship. We are losing institutions that we have counted on, like even something as simple as the diner that you always went to with your parents growing up. You can't go there right now. Like there is so much loss happening. And I hope what this does is broaden people's sense of empathy and create a little bit more of emotional intelligence from the top down, because people at the bottom have always known how hard it is.
Right. Thomas, we just have a couple of minutes left to go. I'm curious about your thoughts on a similar question about, do we have an obligation to come up with a better way to recognize the national bereavement that we might be undergoing as a nation due to this pandemic?
Well, Magna, like Nora, I would resist the impulse to put a math or a commodification on this. We have a body politic that is behaving from the top down like the mayor in the movie Jaws, who's just trying to get the country up and going again, regardless of the medical infrastructure possibly being overwhelmed again. I think we're going to have a generation of unresolved griefs after COVID has had its way with us. And I don't think we're talking weeks. We're going to have to learn to live with COVID. It will be endemic. And in the way that we had to learn to live with the Spanish flu and polio and smallpox and the other things that came and hurt and went their ways, you know, when you're hurt, you have to say, ouch. And I think it is a heavy lift, and I think it requires a real nimble, time-tested, field-tested formula, and I think the funeral provides that. I think the celebration of life, as we call them now, are too often, you know, events to which everyone is invited but the dead guy. You know, the finger food is good, the talk is uplifting, the music is life-affirming. Someone can be counted on to proclaim closure just before the Merlot runs out. I think we must do better than that.
Well, Thomas Lynch is an author, a poet, and an undertaker. With his family, he runs Lynch & Sons Funeral Directors, and his most recent book is The Depositions, New and Selected Essays on Being and Ceasing to Be. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Nora McInerney, host of Terrible, Thanks for Asking, a podcast from American Public Media, author of many books, including No Happy Endings. Nora, it was a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you both. You're so lovely.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.